This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Smoking Scrolls.
Secret Maps at the British Library.
And My London Book Haul. Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the friendly confines of the gaming hut. And today in the gaming hut, mom's going to be pissed. We got the towel under the door in the gaming hut. That's not a good sign. That means either we're going to play Gamma World or we're going to be smoking some stuff we ain't should have been smoking back then. Now, of course, you can smoke whatever you want. Liberty Hall. But when my gaming hut was decored, it was not the done thing. But Robin, you have been inspired perhaps by today's herbed up kids, perhaps by some other thing, to give us a whack F-20 premise for a world building. And why don't you share the inspiration of your wackitude?
So this is a classic misapprehending a cool historical factoid the first time you read it, reaching for social media to post about it, and then going, oh, wait, no, misinterpreting what that meant. Nope. So I was reading about ancient Greek and Roman papyri and how, of course, many works have gone missing, and some of the ones that are very important were found and purchased, like in the 19th century, by people who collected that such things. And there's a story of an Englishman abroad in Egypt who bought a precious papyrus of an ancient text from a group of Egyptian peasants. And according to the way that I first read it, he bought one of the texts, and then they took the others and went off and smoked them for the glue in them. Except, no, they didn't quite do that. It wasn't like it was the equivalent effect of sniffing glue to burn up these, you know, millennia and a half old texts. But they were using them for incense, for the beautiful smell of this old glue in these texts. But that made me think, hey, wait a minute, unlike, you know, mere mortal historians, and not constrained by things that actually happened or, you know, the way that I actually understood it after reading it twice. No, we can do make-em-ups here. So it made me think, hey, wait a minute, you know, in an F20 world, what if magical scrolls, it was perhaps suddenly discovered, or perhaps has always been known, and that's an ongoing issue. What if they produce a potent intoxication when burned and inhaled? So we're going to take this wacko idea and create a weird F20 setting where your competition for your healing spells are people who want to crush them up and smoke them. So, Ken, what does this immediately put you in mind of?
Well, I think that it will work best if it's a recent discovery and it's like a binary toxin. You take a magic scroll and you burn it with a handful of grass or pine needles or something. And it can't be too ridiculous a second ingredient, or else then you couldn't have the huge knock-on effects that you want. Although, I suppose, you know, that could be the slider for the campaign. Is it as rare as saffron, the thing that you burn to get this cool intoxication, in which case it's just a thing for the rich and the powerful? Or can anyone with a plot of grass or cornflower burn it and it feels wonderful and it becomes sort of like a gin or weed or something that everyone can enjoy? And I think it works.
If we want this to suddenly become a thing, it could be the case that a previously rare second ingredient suddenly becomes common, right? That the Nutmeg Islands start exporting nutmeg in bulk, where previously it was a rare thing, and now there's lots of nutmeg, and this suddenly makes it something lots of people can do.
Right. So the notion being that you used to have, and I think, again, this works even better in a world where the scroll is the standard method of distributing and gaining magic. That if you're a wizard, you go through the world with your scrolls, and they, just like, you know, in, I think, super old school D&D, you cast from a scroll and the scroll unwrites itself, and then that magic is gone. And that's how, you know, all magic works, except for straight up divine magic. Even sorcerers, even warlocks, everybody else has to at least have a scroll with a writing on it, whether it's their demon deal for a warlock or it's the way that they draw a diagram for the sorcerer. There has to be something that then evanesces when you cast the spell. You can reuse the parchment, but it's the ink and the discipline that makes the difference. And it is the magic that makes the high. So if you just scribble, even in magic ink, on a piece of parchment and burn it, nothing happens except you've wasted a bunch of money. But if there's magic in it, then people get ecstatic. And I believe that, you know, if you begin with it sort of being a known thing that very decadent, very powerful mages used to do, and then the mages would always claim, oh no, when you get high burning nutmeg and scrolls, you have insights into magic, and it helps you level up and be a much higher level than you'll ever be, you schmucks. But whether that's, you know, a sort of a bunch of druggies making excuses, you know, no, you really understand the world, man, or whether it's actually true, because it could be in a world of magic, you don't know, because you've never done it until, as you say, the ships come in from the Nutmeg Islands and they say, there is so much nutmeg over there, you will not believe. Anyway, here you go, flumph, and suddenly nutmeg is on every middle-class table and working-class bar and available to be turned into a moral panic by people who get mad at people doing drugs. But in this case, they're doing drugs with a strategic resource, in some sense, for the civilization, because every lightning bolt spell you get high from, you can't go use to fight orcs or whatever, and that is a situation, correct?
So, I guess we have to back up a bit and envision in this world. I think it's explained in D&D and other F20 worlds where scrolls come from, which is that there seems to be a non-adventuring class of magicians or perhaps magically adept craftsmen who make these things, but it's difficult and expensive. And in the case of the scroll that you have to cast from, you have to, you know, embed the components of the spell in it often. But at any rate, it's got to be rare, because we are would assume, first of all, that people who are literate enough to make scrolls are rare to begin with. People who have the connection to magic to do it, they are essentially probably like casting the spells into the text. So this can't be cheap, right? This is an expensive drug. And even if everybody has nutmeg, not everybody can afford scrolls. And this is going to make them even more rare. So the threat of this discovery may in fact be that, you know, a stable society that enables magicians. They produce enough scrolls for people to learn magic, plus, you know, a surplus for you to take down into the dungeon to give your, you know, your bonus on top of your usual spell slots that you have. So that's great. But if suddenly the rich and weird start buying up scrolls in order to smoke them, that means there's going to be an interruption in the supply of magicians. So this assumes the sort of F20-like relative commonality of magicians and magic, where it's sort of more of a technology than it is in a lot of earlier fantasy stories, where like there's one wizard. Well, here there's a whole infrastructure to presumably generate more wizards to be a strategic resource if you're a ruler, right? If you've worried about your neighbor invading you, you want to fund a college of magic. You want to get people trained up in fireball or detection or whatever it is that you want to use. And now all of a sudden, anyone in the society who is smart enough to worry about that sort of thing wants their neighbors to smoke all of their scrolls and wants to make it illegal to smoke scrolls in their kingdom because they want to use that to train up and empower wizards, right?
Yeah. So the real first thing that happens is that every scroll, and I don't know if we want to have a sliding scale like the higher level spells give you an even better or longer lasting high. That's another question to ask. But even a basic scroll, a good old first level, you know, charm person or whatever, is worth a lot more money or a lot more, you know, in terms of what you can get for it than you're maybe going to get out of an average dungeon. That you can sell this scroll to either the local scroll dealer or the scroll lord, or you can go into business yourself. You can go find a rich bourgeoisie with an itch and make the deal if that's the kind of deal you want to get into, or maybe that's what the thief gets to do now, is make all those deals with the scrolls that you find or don't use on the mission. So there's always going to be that temptation to, well, I don't know if we need all those scrolls to go into the dungeon. Maybe some of them could be turned into solid gold goodies first.
Yes. Does Rogerio really need, you know, identify item? We don't care about that. Let's sell this. And that could be a source of, you know, tension within some groups. Like, presumably you would dampen it down so it wouldn't be actual interplayer tension, but it'd be an issue, right? It's like, well, normally I would learn this spell, which I can use every so often, but I don't know. It's worth a lot of money. You might also have a situation where, you know, your patron gives you a scroll of water breathing in order to get through this particular flooded area of the dungeon. And you go, is there a way we can do this without using up the scroll and then also sell the scroll? So that could be a sort of an interesting additional level of problem solving, right? Is that you could play with that idea and have people trying to come up with inventive ways to be able to pretend that they use their scrolls and then go off and flog them for more money.
Yeah, the notion of, you know, clamping down on nutmeg, because that would be the thing that would be clamped down on first. Certainly there'd be a lot of, you have to have a magic user's guild license to be possessing a scroll in the first place, might be a thing that gets added. That's probably a pretty good rule regardless, if people can just wander around casting lightning bolt. But you definitely are going to see, you know, the clamp down on nutmeg, which gives you all the story hooks that every other illegal black market trade gives you. And so suddenly the Thieves Guild is also running nutmeg to rich merchants or to middling nobles or to whatever. And I guess
it's
you also have the
Sudafed of scroll huffing.
Right. Is the king or the lord of this area, whatever you know, the top guy is he the kind of guy who's trying to, you know, do the right thing and clamp down on scroll burning? Or is he a big scroll addict and is the whole situation gone to heck under his reign? Because even if there's still the same laws, all the king's watch are corrupt because they know that any good scrolls go to the palace for a reward. And that simultaneously you've got the problem of the scrolls being, you know, snatched up from you on bogus pretexts by the cops, but also you've got the problem of the kingdom is not being particularly well run because the king is getting baked all the time, and the orcs who practice shamanic magic and don't have those scroll problems are getting closer, as is that neighboring theocracy with the much stricter social control and less access to nutmeg, they're sharpening their tau cross-shaped spears and looking hungry. And maybe it's a bad situation to find yourself in this perhaps enjoyable, but definitely not long for this world little duchy that is the hotbed of a scroll high.
Now, the rumors might be going around the duchy that, in fact, it's the Magician's Guild that's behind this, that they've created a big ritual effect. Because what this does is that reinforces their cartel, that if there are fewer magicians and if people are no longer able to learn magic as well, that means the people who know magic are in higher demand. And perhaps there is a clique of hidebound magicians or just people who want to protect. Because if you're someone who goes and, you know, casts spells for money, not only has the value of scrolls gone up, but the value of your being able to cast spells, which you already know, you've learned, your prices go up because suddenly there are few, well, not, you know, over several years, there are fewer of you. So it may well be that this is some clever attempt to, after all, it's a guild. That's what guilds do. They restrict who can engage in a particular profession. And in this case, it might be credible, but wrong. That they are doing this as a protectionist measure, or you, the outsiders who have been already sort of shut out by the snooty higher-ups at the guild, realize that this is a big conspiracy on their part, and that could be the thing that you investigate in order to reset the setting back to sort of a more normal D&D situation where nobody is smoking the scrolls. You have to undo that ceremonial magic, but hey, what if the king is really into that? What if the insights that he's been gaining through Fireball are, in fact, the things that made him a master tactician? And if he can no longer smoke Fireball spells, he'll suddenly be terrible on the battlefield again. And he wants that magic back. What do you do about that? Do you undo the ceremonial spell and then agree to recreate it, except, you know, maybe just localized to the castle or something?
I think more realistically, the king getting baked on Fireball meant that the job of tactics would devolve to the Grand Marshal, and the Marshal was actually good at his job when the king wasn't jogging his elbow the whole time. And now that the king's not distracted, he's giving lots of good and helpful advice and countermanding orders and stuff. So either way, that could roll.
That could be the cause of the conspiracy, is right. People know that the king or the duke is a giant druggie, and they found the perfect drug for him, and they want to keep him supplied so that the merchant class can rise up or the chancellor can be in charge. So that could be another surprise force behind this strange change.
And I think we do want to address the question. I think it makes some sense that higher level spells give you a longer or more powerful high. I think that probably makes sense. The question we do also want to ask is, do the specific spells affect the trip? I think it'd be fun if they did, but then that might turn this into a druggy dreamland sort of a campaign where it's like, oh, I'm going to smoke a lightning bolt and commune with Thor. That'll be great. And then suddenly your game is about communing with Thor and not about whatever you thought it was about, which is fine.
Yeah. If you're worried about that, you can just specify that the hallucinations are just that, right? That
right.
You're not
yeah.
authentic magical visions that you would get if you, you know, go and hang out with the priests of Thor, but these are just, you know, essentially a source of confusion. So you can have both true and untrue visions, which
right.
is also something that most cultures that recognize visions, well, not all of them are valid. So
right.
this could be something where you can preserve that so that now someone in the group, some player, perhaps the aforementioned thief, or I'm looking at you, bards, will undoubtedly smoke a spell in order to see what happens. And you could have some fun with that. And you could leave open the question of whether an authentic Dreamlands thing is happening, or if you're just tripping out of your gourd as something that you decide and have the players find out, or you just go with whatever's, you know, more fun in the campaign you're running.
And then I guess the other sort of question that you're asking is, you know, it seems like a waste of an experience in D&D if this tripping does not expose you to monsters who you have to fight. That whether it's really or not really Thor up there, if you smoke Lightning Bolt, you are going to be fighting like a Lightning Modron or some kind of a Planescape monster. This will give you your excuse to get out Manual of the Planes and use all the monsters from there. And you're dealing with some sort of psychic monster that will go after you. And you're having, you know, the equivalent of a bad trip if you didn't set it up right. But killing those dream monsters, maybe it gives you experience. Maybe it only gives you experience in magic. Maybe that is why the high-level mages have been doing this with the Nutmeg for 100 years before the Nutmeg Islands were discovered, and is because that is the only way to level up past 10th, is to fight these hallucination monsters. And maybe they're all the hallucination monsters are in league with the Mind Flayers or somebody, some telepathic horrible monster or a giant dream god, a dreaming god perhaps, who's slumbering and is only awakened after the Nutmeg Islands are discovered because he's under this. Oh, no, that's a different game. But the notion that there is now this new opportunity slash threat opportunity, like everything in F20, and you have this new flank of the universe to explore. And what if there's magical treasure in these visions? And what if some of it can be taken out of those visions with proper techniques that you learn? And it requires the rogue has to be high because he has to have his magical connection to stealing stuff amped up. The fighter has to be high so that he can fight the dream monster because the magicians aren't good at fighting. And you have to know everyone has to do it, or else it isn't going to be fun, guys. And suddenly peer pressure in your own party. What a shame. What a shame to have to see it. Look away. Look away, gamers of the 80s. That's not for you.
Well, now that we're going on a vision quest and this is turning into the Mythos Hut, I think it's time for us to exit this hut and see what hut and or advisory waits for us on the other side.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
a childhood haunted by strife and a shadowy being,
Deceit and Survival on the spaceship Earth Again,
a stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
the screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws,
the Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
a love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens,
behind the music drama in the LA punk scene,
the arrival of a telepathic stranger on a space-bound way station,
tragic love between a vampire and a mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways. The announcements ring out from the Tannoy, but they ring out about latitude and longitude. The destination board displays where all the trains are going, but it displays them in the form of a cartogram. We're on platform 9 3/4 between the cartography hut and the travel advisory, apparently, where both of these worlds blend. Or maybe we're just standing in St. Pancras looking at our maps trying to figure out what line to take. Because, as always, when Robin and I have gone to Dragonmeet, we have returned with knowledge of a exhibition. And in this case, it was the Secret Maps exhibition at the British Library, which runs through January 18th. And you really didn't have to ask us twice. I put in a good faith effort to find other things we could do, but it said Secret Maps right on the box, Robin. What can we do? Right. We're only human.
Yes, it did say Secret Maps. And so really the name of this exhibit could have been, hey, Ken and Robin, here's about 18 cartography hut topics for you.
Right.
But I think that would not have been as big a draw as the actual title they settled on, which is Secret Maps. And I believe even though you loved this exhibition, you still have a rant about the bait and switch nature of that framing.
Many of the maps were in no wise secret. For example, there was a lovely map done for the Emperor Charles V to show his global possessions. And, did he keep it secret? No, he put it up on the wall. He invited people to see it. He said, look at my amazing global possessions. I'm Emperor Charles V. Well, this was a copy of that map done in 1570 by an Italian. Was that secret? Nope, he just copied it. Put it in a book. That's what he did. So it's many of the maps, I think, were just cool maps. They were not secret maps. And some of them, Robin, you'll be shocked to hear, not even maps. We had, for example, John Dee's magic showstone, his obsidian mirror that he would gaze into, or rather ask Edward Kelly to gaze into and describe the angels there. Now, this is many wonderful things, but a map, it is not. And they said, well, John Dee drew maps and this showstone is secret, so hey. And at some point you're like, you just want to show off that you have John Dee's showstone. And I get it. I also would be working it into every conversation I could if I owned it, but have a little self-respect, British Library. Yeah. That's all I have to say.
Also, their Treasures of the British Library exhibit was closed at the moment, so they
right. So they had know, to put the showstone somewhere.
John Dee magic mirror on display at all times.
No point in having a shoe stone if you can't shoe it off. That's what I always say.
Right. Yes, and some other maps were also shoehorned in. I think the actual theme was maps as instruments of power, although that didn't fully
also would not have
cover every map, and also would have been secret maps. Let's give them that. They definitely needed the admissions. Also, about half of the exhibit space was just raw particle board, not even painted. And there was a little plaque justifying how this somehow connected to secret maps. But really, the plaque should have just said Brexit, right? Because the other half of the exhibit was surfaced in the usual black walls that you're familiar with from exhibits. The, I think, most interesting thematic part of it about its look at maps as instruments of power was the fact that the British, of course, this is the British Library, so many of the maps are British, and the Empire very systematically, carefully mapped all of the territories that it occupied in order to divvy them up. And of course, they would show up somewhere, go, hey, are there any people around here? There's people up on that ridge. Oh, no, forget those people. There aren't farms, so this place is uninhabited. Let's, you know, divvy it up. And so that was part of the colonial project, was to carefully map things. The extremely ironic fact that I didn't know until this exhibit was that England itself was not mapped in any sort of detailed way until fairly late into the 19th century because of privacy concerns. Because we're not going to let you map us. We know what that's the first step towards, is government control and occupation. Heck no. So
we didn't map Ireland over carefully and to the last detail over the last 100 years to have you turn around to do it to us. That's not the way it works.
Yeah. So that is, I think, the most telling detail as far as the actual theme of the show, as opposed to the advertised theme of the show. But there's just a ton of cool maps. And the other thing that whenever I see a ton of cool old maps, I'm reminded how far actual maps, even into the Renaissance, are from the perfectly detailed, properly laid out, accurate maps that we see of fantasy worlds. That if there were character facing maps, they would be weird squiggles with all sorts of, you know, they'd have owlbears drawn on them in the corners.
Right.
They would be a confusing mess the way that, you know, period maps were until very, very recently. So, Ken, there are lots of favorite maps to point to. One of the ones I liked was that Walter Raleigh's map of the Guyana expedition. He was off looking for El Dorado. This is where John Dee comes in. John Dee said, hey, El Dorado's probably over there. And Walter Raleigh took his advice, I think, along with other people. And that's why he came back with that map that takes a while to decipher and has a weird sort of a cult thing in the middle of it.
Yeah, that map is so cool. There's a whole Charles Nicoll book about it called The Creature in the Map, about the mystical nature of Guyana and the expeditions thereunto. It's very cool.
There's the first treasure map with an X marking the spot is there. It's a map of Ireland Island in Bermuda from 1694. Were there other maps that struck you, Ken, as particularly exciting?
I very much enjoyed the illicit map of the Tibetan approaches from the 1880s that they had up on the wall that was done, according to the brief description that I read, by a rogue lama. I guess he was mad at his other lamas, and so he went and, you know, charted out his steps and figured out how to map the ways into Tibet and then sold that map to the hated British. The British had a whole unit in the British survey, speaking of topics for the cartography hut, called the Pundits, who were native surveyors who were trained to do surveying in their head, basically. And this guy maybe was a pundit and the description got it wrong, or maybe he knew the same sort of techniques, because again, counting and walking and measuring are not things that only the British had figured out by the 1880s. And the Tibetans, one assumes, were pretty good at counting and measuring in your head, because that was a whole bunch of meditative practice. And this lama obviously would have been it. And as anyone with the most cursory knowledge of my interests knows, hand-drawn sketch maps by T.E. Lawrence will always have a pride of place in my heart. We had two of them. We had a little squiggle drawing of a oasis on the edge of, I think it looked like it was in the Hejaz somewhere. Maybe it was up near Aqaba. And he has a little note that says, palm trees are not a mile high, because of course he'd drawn the oasis with palm trees, but he was a cartographer, so he was also drawing stuff to scale. And he was a imp and a gadabout, so he made fun of it in the thing. And then there was a more serious, proper, send this to your superiors map about sort of approaches in the upper Hejaz that were, I assume, to be worked with logistics to support the Arab revolt with the Royal Navy.
Some of the most game supplement ready maps included, there's a map of the fortifications at Luxembourg, which is a cutaway with like six different cross sections of it, which I think, you know, that's definitely a super cool thing and very much like something you would find in a game book. There's also a map from the invasion of D-Day where they've carefully mapped the possible range of every single German gun on the cliffs with these great looping patterns of ranges for that. So that's something that is, you know, straight out of an Avalon Hill box, I would think.
And they had the radio lines where you could tune into a sort of an early version of GPS to find out where your ship was, but it was so secret that they only turned that system on for D-Day. That they had this thing, but obviously once you have it on, the Germans would be able to figure out where your ships are. And so they can't have it on all the time, but it was so important to have all the ships in their correct positions for D-Day that they turned it on. And there was a map showing you, or a chart, I guess, technically, showing you where in the English Channel you should be to get those signals and then start following them to know where your ship was at all times, which in 1944 was a miracle. It was a miracle in 1984, for goodness sake, to be able to do that. And so that was very interesting to me, that this sort of proto-GPS thing was so secret and so powerful that it could only be turned on during actual D-Day and not on any other moment of the war.
In keeping with their marketing to dads, other D-Day-related items, there was a bogus planning map with locations obscured on it. They were replaced with other locations to trick whoever of the wrong hands it fell into. So instead of the actual locations, there were such labels as Venice, Georgetown, and in case you wondered if this was a British map, Rugger and Cricket. There were also the secret maps that paratroopers were given in order to navigate around once they landed. And famously, a thing I'd heard of but never seen, the repurposed versions of these, because they were printed on silk. Silk was very rare for years after the war, and so some of them were turned into lingerie. So there's a bra and knicker set that was formerly a top secret a map. So I have now actually seen that thing that I'd long heard of.
Without having to take liberties with Lady Mountbatten, which was the previous way you got to see that knicker set.
I would never do such a thing.
Never. There was also, of course, some cool, you know, uses of the negative space on maps. There was an early British map of Dover that just left off Dover Castle. Take that, the French. Try and find Dover Castle. It's at the castle. It's up there on the... All right, damn it. But still. And then we had apartheid era maps around Johannesburg that left off Soweto, which is an interesting way to, I think, confuse people who live in Johannesburg, surely, more than anything else. I think
that was like maintain your spirit of denial by not having this on a map.
Exactly. By getting your motorists lost. Well, no one said apartheid was smart. And then Soviet era maps of Moscow, they had the taxi drivers, almost a cartogram of Moscow that they had to release during the Olympics that still had lots of areas in red that said, don't drive anyone here. And then also you could see other Soviet era maps that had left off, you know, whole factories, Magnitogorsk. They left off the whole industrial plant area of Magnitogorsk because that was the secret half. And they compared it to air photos that showed, nope, there's the factory. And then, of course, there was many wonderful spy satellite and spy plane photographs of various Soviet facilities for interest and love, as well as Soviet maps. I think they had the one that they had there was of Belfast that the Soviets had made from captured German war maps and from their own spies, I guess, getting a Belfast street atlas. It's not like there was anything really secret about Belfast, except the watchtowers that the hated British stood in. Those were left off the local maps of Belfast and Londonderry as well. Again, despite the fact that any local knows where the watchtowers are, they're not hidden. They're standing there, you know, being angry at the locals.
Yes, it wasn't so much as a secret as a thing that must not be acknowledged. But let's not say there were no secret maps. There were absolutely secret maps. So they had copies of the maps that were smuggled from Tokugawa Japan by the famous Franz von Siebold, the doctor and culture collector and also spy, who was employed by the Dutch East India Company. It was completely illegal to supply a map to a foreigner in Japan at that time, but he befriended some officials and indeed did get that map out. Also, there are cases where the map is not secret, but the annotations on the map are secret. So there was a map of North America marked up by a British diplomat named Richard Oswald for use in the 1783 Treaty of Paris territorial carve-up that determined where British North America ended and the United States of America began. And this, of course, would have been a big negotiating point as to this is what we want. This is what we're willing to give. So the map isn't secret, but the marks on the map are. So you would have to prevent that from falling into the hands of your negotiating partners.
And then when the border became a ruction again in the 1840s, apparently the British government reclassified the map. It had been sitting out after the Treaty of Paris, and then we're now arguing over the border of Maine, and so they hide the map because the map said that the British said the border of Maine was where the Americans later said it was in the 1840s, and the British can't be held to anything they might have said. That's not the way you keep perfidious in perfidious Albion. So the map was secret, then it was unsecret, and then it was secret again. So that was fun.
And there were some great sort of oddball maps. There was a satirical map, the map of Green Bag Land, which was a comment on the 1818 bid to remove Carolina Brunswick from the British succession. And there was a whole to-do about that and establishing that she was having an affair. And that was enough to have a map drawn about it. Also seems to cry out for a future History Hut episode. And Ken, were there Liptonic maps?
Were there? There were not as many as there maybe should have been, but there was an enormous, beautiful one. There was a good old standard map of Secret Eden. Nothing wrong with the Garden of Eden. That was from 1905, heyday of theosophy. But there's also...
And that was submerged under the Pacific and Indian Ocean. So it's also sort of...
Well, yeah, if it was out there, you could find it, Robin. Yeah. I mean, think about it.
I'm just clarifying things for the
listener. But not submerged forever, because as Gordon Michael Scallion would remind us, once the magnetic fields flip over and Atlantis and Lemuria are revealed, then the world changes. And he had a really big, beautiful color map of the world after the magnetic field inversion, the Earth Changes map. And that was from 1996. And that, of course, was a thing of beauty and a joy forever.
Well, people who know the episode in which we recount our museum visit know what else we recount. So let's listen to an exciting and reassuring commercial and then come back for the familiar yet shockingly different version of that segment set. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
that span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Stop this podcast from going up in smoke by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Scott Stefanski,
Tim Morgan,
Linda and Mike Schiffer,
Peter Nix,
and Philip Masters. And yes, indeed, it is time for Ken's Bookshelf. This is the segment where we vicariously paw through the books that Ken has acquired for himself on one of his trips. And the London trip bookshelf is the granddaddy of them all. It's one where I thought of this segment and also probably this whole podcast. So I've seen you paw through these books, but now everybody gets to hear you paw through them. But there's a terrifying twist, Ken. What was it?
The terrifying twist, Robin, is the Treadwells, pound for pound, my favorite occult bookstore in London and possibly the world, was closed on Mondays this time. So we were not able to go for a last hurrah to Treadwell's. And somehow Watkins, another perfectly great occult bookstore, never entered my radar. So instead, we went to Atlantis Bookshop, which is where, of course, Aleister Crowley used to hang out and annoy people and pester the help. And the wonderful people at Atlantis Bookshop celebrate his death day, not in the same way that perhaps I would celebrate his death day. They're more celebrating the spirit and the joie de vivre of Aleister Crowley, but they're lovely people and they're still there doing the good work right by the British Museum on Museum Street. So we picked up a few trifles there at Atlantis, but it was sad not to go to Treadwell's and see the eyes of the Treadwell's woman widen as she once more saw, oh, it's the American. Here he is, told of in legend, to pay the mortgage.
Well, if she wanted the American, she shouldn't have closed on Monday.
I agree.
And also, you'll hear a lot of espionage books because for the Secret Max exhibit, the British Library Bookstore stocked up extra on espionage books. And so you stocked up too. But let's go further back in time with the first item on the list, which is A Short History of Tomb Raiding, The Epic Hunt for Egypt's Treasures by Maria Galea.
This is, again, just what it says on the tin. It goes back to the early eras of, you know, Egyptian later dynasties robbing the tombs of earlier dynasties and Egyptian peasants who don't care what dynasty they are robbing the tombs. And then it goes into the eras of Hellenistic and then Arabic Roman rulers of Egypt and the amount of tomb robbing that they got up to. And then finally, we end with the tomb robbing that was done with a bunch of letters after your name, where you're an archaeologist officially, but you're still out running around tomb robbing. And also, of course, sparking a new market in entrepreneurial and exciting tomb robbing, because once all the easy tombs were found, the local peasantry said, well, I guess that's it. But suddenly if Europeans are showing up and offering hard cash money for the stuff that's in those tombs, they'll do a little harder work and go out and look in some caves a second, third, fifth, 19th time until they find every last little bit of stuff. And some of that stuff does indeed wind up in a museum. Some of that stuff gets burned for the delicious smell of the glue, as you mentioned previously, and some of the stuff gets melted down and turned into the rent, which is, I guess, better than having it go on to follow a pharaoh in the afterlife, but maybe not quite as good as having it in a museum where we can all look at it and enjoy it. So there we are, but it's a clear role-playing adjacent thing, and because it takes a synoptic view going all the way back into ancient Egyptian tomb robbing, I think it's super valuable for world building as well, and great fun.
Also pertinent, The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, An Extraordinary New Journey Through History's Greatest Treasure by Bettany Hughes.
Yeah, I've got a number of Seven Wonders books. This is another one. By this time, I think I almost sort of have a collection of Seven Wonders books. This one's from 2024, so I knew I didn't own it because they all have the exact same title. And so the real curious thing for me about this book is where Bettany Hughes, the author, comes down on the Hanging Gardens of Babylon controversy, because there is a school of thought that seems to believe that when Antipater of Sidon wrote down the first list of the Seven Wonders, that there were no Hanging Gardens of Babylon to see, and he just hoped no one would check up and go to Babylon. I don't know how much you can argue that that's the case for something that was self-consciously a travel literature, but there we are. So it'll be interesting to see what Bettany Hughes says about that.
Speaking of travel, the thing you need to travel with is a globe. So that takes us to This Earthly Globe, A Venetian Geographer and the Quest to Map the World by Andrea de Robillant.
Yeah, Andrea de Robillant has done some other stuff. He did the history of the Zeno manuscript voyage that we talked about earlier. You know, this is his nut, is Venetian intellectual history, it turns out. And this is the basically biography, not quite the biography of Giambattista Ramuzio, the geographer who compiled it, but the biography of the book that he compiled, Journeys and Navigations, Navigationi e Viaggi. And this is Ramuzio compiling narratives from all around the world, some of them top secret at the time, speaking of secret maps, some of them not secret. But he, for example, is the first guy to print Pigafetta's voyage in full, the story of Magellan's circumnavigation. No one else had done that. People who are fans of travel literature and exploration literature may know about Richard Hakluyt, the British geographer who did the same thing, but he did it in English and he did it 40 years after Ramuzio. And so Ramuzio is an interesting guy. He's also a very high up part of the Venetian government. He's basically the archivist for the Council of Ten, which is the Venetian secret government. So this is as if in his copious free time, J. Edgar Hoover had been assembling a map of the world. So pretty great. And, you know, I've got my Venice thing. I got my map thing. More than enough reason to own this book.
When in London, buy a book on London. If you're going to buy a book on London, who better than one by Peter Ackroyd? In this case, Colors of London, A History.
Yeah, this one is basically what Ackroyd does with his London books is he takes some line of country and he just sort of runs down it and, given his vast panoply of London knowledge, attaches to it. So in this case, rather than talk about London geographically or historically, he's talking about all the colors that you see when you're out in London. And sadly, Robin, there is no yellow. There is gold, but there's no yellow. So my hope of a Carcosan London was shattered.
Yellow's too dangerous. You can't have the yellow in there. I'm sure Peter Ackroyd talked to the lawyers, and I support that.
But we got light fire, white, gold, blue, green, red, brown, gray, black, the night, and the full spectrum. And then lots of photos of London, many of them colorized, because obviously it's called The Colors of London. So great fun. The great Peter Ackroyd. There's so many wonderful ways you can go at London in a book, and Peter Ackroyd is going to do them all, by God.
A map we didn't talk about that was at the Secret Map Show, but also in the gift shop, unlike others, was General Strike Map. I'm not going to list off the code numbers, but it's the General Strike Map from 1926, reprinted by the Charles Close Society.
Yeah, the Charles Close Society reprints maps. That's their jam, and mostly maps of places in Britain. I went to their website after buying this. It looks great. If you want the, you know, Ordnance Survey map of Hertfordshire, they can probably hook you up with the coolest, oldest one. Modern ones, you just go to the British government and they'll eventually ungorge it. But this map was a map of London. There was the standard map of London. And then there were strategic points that the government drew on, that if the strikers get here, trouble will ensue. This is the bad news. There's like areas where they might rally. So it's sort of the planning map that the British government used and the police, London police, used to corral the general strike of 1926. And that map was in the Secret Maps exhibition because it was at the time a top secret map. And now you can buy it in the gift shop, which is the ideal fate of all secret maps.
Right. And it's top secret because it has all of the vulnerable sites
right.
that the authorities wanted protected. So that's mm-hmm. why they immediately afterwards withdrew it and declared it secret. Cause it's like, here's a wish list. If someone wants to attack London, they would strike all these places. So it was a sensitive map at the time. Now we come to The Golden Age of Murder, The Mystery of the Writers Who Invented the Modern Detective Story by Martin Edwards.
Yes, Martin Edwards is the archivist of the Detection Society, which is the Society of Detective Writers founded in the 20s by Dorothy Sayers and Ronald Knox and all these great figures. And he is doing his part to keep the Golden Age of Detection alive. He curates the British Library's reprint series of Golden Age of Detection books that has, you know, gone from strength to strength to strength. This is basically the gossipy story of the early detection club. There is no actual mystery of the writers. It's not like, you know, we don't know who Dorothy Sayers was, but this is sort of what were they doing? In what way are they in communication or in conversation, rather, with existing forensic ability, with existing true crime literature, with existing actual crime news? And so that sort of level of, not quite sociology, but cultural history is something that has not been done a great deal about the Golden Age of Detection writers, certainly not outside their individual biographies. And so Edwards is trying to take a sort of synoptic view of the whole field, in this case, through the lens of the Detection Society, which is a great way to do it. And since that society includes many, many wonderful great writers, although it never got around to including Josephine Tay, Shakes fingers at Detection Society, it is not quite perfect, but it does have John Dixon Carr. So you take your wins where you can.
Now we come to the beginnings of the two fat stacks of spy books with Cracking the Crab, Russian Espionage Against Japan from Peter the Great to Richard Sorge by James D.J. Brown, which I assume is exactly what the title says it is.
It is exactly what the title says. And by now, I have plenty of Richard Sorge books. I don't need any more Richard Sorge. But if you're promising me a Russian spy story going back to the 18th century, then you have my attention, sir. And that is where I increasingly begin to make these sorts of decisions about spy narratives is, are they going back before the sort of conventional beginning of espionage history around World War One? And in this case, it very much is. It goes back, as it says, to Peter the Great. We are going all the way down. We have espionage in the Russo-Japanese War. We don't even get to the Bolsheviks until page 123. So we're halfway through the book almost, maybe a little under a third of the way of the book through before you get to what I consider the sort of orthodox history of espionage. So it's the first 120 pages of this book alone would justify buying it in my mind.
Now, because our schedule is a little weird, you've had time to actually read one of these books. And the one you selected is Quest for Kim in Search of Kipling's Great Game by Peter Hopkirk.
Yeah, Peter Hopkirk, his basic job after he got out of the army was he was a correspondent for the Times of London. And in his copious free time, he wrote histories of Russian and British maneuverings in the Great Game, the attempt to gain influence and power in Southern Asia from, call it, 1820 to 1907. And he wrote a bunch of those histories. He wrote five, including the British versus the Kaiser in the Great Game in World War One, and the British versus Lenin in the immediate post-war era. And for the longest time, I thought that these five books were the whole of Peter Hopkirk's output. And they were wonderful. I was reading them in hardback as they were coming out in when I was in grad school and discovering that perhaps the reason that the best histories of the Great Game are written by a journalist is that no academic department is interested in such things. But I very much enjoyed those books. So we're at Foyles. I see a uniform edition of Peter Hopkirk. I think, oh, that's nice. They have all five books, except they had a sixth. And the sixth is The Quest for Kim, which is him looking at Rudyard Kipling's novel, Kim, which was, it turns out, the thing that he read at age 13 that got him interested in the great game in the first place. So this whole wonderful career that he had comes from reading Kim. This is him sort of giving back and saying, all right, we know that Kipling based the character of the museum guy on his own father, Lockwood Kipling. We know that there's a real canon in the grounds at Lahore. We know all these other things. How much more of Kim can we chart to an actual person? And it turns out a remarkable number of figures in Kim that I had thought were completely made up are at least Romana clefs of actual figures, including figures new to me that did not turn up in previous Peter Hopkirk books. So as a literary explication, it's wonderful. As a love letter to Kim, it's wonderful. And it also gave me more leads for British espionage in the 19th century. So it succeeds on all metrics.
I'm excited to see a Paddington book here. Britannia and the Bear. Oh, wait. Touch's earpiece. This is Britannia and the Bear, the Anglo-Russian Intelligence Wars, 1917 to 1929, by Victor Madeira.
And this is a topic that has been pretty well looked at, but I don't think I have a single synoptic overview of it. What I have is a bunch of books on Riley Ace of Spies. I have stuff on the Zinoviev letter. I have stuff on various MI5 operations against the Comintern. But I do not have a broad history of the espionage conflict in the period, or I did not until just now. And this is exactly what it says, as you say. It's Britain versus Russia in spycraft, 1917 to 1929. There was a lot of it because Lenin and then Stalin were very much opposed to the British Empire. They hated them much worse than they ever hated America until after the war. So Britain was enemy number one, and MI6 and 5 slowly came around to figuring that out. And this is the story of that slow figure.
This is a biography of someone who I would dare not give this name to if they were a fictional character. This is A Suspicion of Spies, Risk, Secrets and Shadows, the biography of Wilfred Biffy Dunderdale by Tim Spicer.
Yeah, Biffy was a sort of major figure in MI6. He began in Odessa running anti-Red operations and then ran through into the World War II and the Cold War. He is one of the 8 million people that people say was the model for James Bond. One can perhaps not quite imagine Sean Connery turning, quirking an eyebrow and saying, the name is Biffy. Biffy Bond. But, you know, he's a major figure in the history of MI6, and so it's nice to have a biography of him. It's one I didn't have.
Next, we come to Intercept, The Secret History of Computers and Spies by Gordon Carrera.
Yeah, Gordon Carrera, another well-known espionage historian. Good stuff all the way around. And this is the basically, you know, taking cyber espionage, which is becoming ever bigger a part of espionage, and saying, how far back can we take it? And this goes at least to Bletchley Park. I assume it really gets its feet under it at Bletchley Park, because there's not a lot of computers before then. And then what I'm hoping it does is, not that I, you know, don't love Bletchley, but again, I have a ton of books on it. What I hope it does is it sort of carries us well into the 21st century by now, because a lot of these sorts of spy histories sort of tend to go out in murmurs and embarrassed politeness noises after the Cold War is over. But by now, surely a good historian like Carrera can pull us into the present.
So that's stack one of spy books. We'll tackle stack two after this exciting commercial message. December 5th, 1775. A wagon train led by bookseller-turned-artillery officer Henry Knox arrives at Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York.
His goal, haul captured British cannons through the snowy mountains to the siege of Boston and drive the Redcoats from the cradle of liberty.
This year, Henry Knox's noble train of artillery delivers presents not to General Washington, but to you!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Visit nationsandcannons.com and use promo code CANON at checkout for 17.75% off and free PDFs of your books. And we're back in Ken's bookshelf with your London haul. he says, as if this is a radio show that you could tune into midway through. And we're still looking at spy books, starting with Behind the Enigma, the Authorized History of GCHQ, Britain's Secret Cyber Intelligence Agency by John Ferris.
Yeah, the thing about this is that I had my choice of two GCHQ books. I had this one, and I had GCHQ, The Uncensored Story of Britain's Most Secret Intelligence Agency by Richard Aldrich. And the trouble is that I had a smaller than normal suitcase this time because British Airways has systematically destroyed all my larger suitcases. So I had to think of my poor wrists and only buy one GCHQ book. And in this particular case, the reason I picked this GCHQ book is it goes all the way back to 1844 in the beginnings of British organized signals intelligence, whereas, of course, even an uncensored history is going to start with the actual beginning of GCHQ, which was a good bit later, 20th century. So once more, my desire to have more espionage information about the pre-1914 era meant that this is the book that I took, even though it is the authorized history of GCHQ, and so will therefore probably downplay any grotesque fumbles that GCHQ may have made. I'll get the Aldrich one eventually, but I only had so much that I could grab at any given time this trip.
Right. So listen up, espionage writers. If you want to sell to Ken, start your narrative as early as you can.
Exactly.
Next, we come to The Eagle in the Mirror, The Greatest Spy Story Never Told by Jesse Fink. Is it, Ken? Is it The Greatest Spy Story Never Told?
Well, I haven't read it, so I can't judge right now. But it is the biography of Dick Ellis, who was a crucial MI6 figure in sort of getting America into the spy game. He began as one of the people whose job was to get America into World War II. And then once we did, he took it upon himself to work very closely with Wild Bill Donovan at the creation of the OSS and help get America's spy agencies up to snuff. Sort of, you know, you send them in. At that time, MI6 was the finest intelligence agency in the world. And any little bit of hint he could give to Donovan, I'm sure, was gleefully snapped up. And interestingly, there has been a rumor for a long old time that Dick Ellis was also a traitor, that he had betrayed Britain both to the Nazis and the communists, which is a nice trick if you can do it. And this book, I believe, is an attempt to say, no, he didn't. So I'm hoping that it covers the controversy, teaches the controversy, as we say, but whether it does or not, that period where Dick Ellis is helping Wild Bill get the OSS off the ground is obviously fertile game information from Delta Green on down. And it's also a story that I didn't actually have a book on. So now I do.
A less covered subject in espionage, especially in English, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel by Maddie Friedman.
Yeah, these are four guys who are undercover agents in Beirut in 1948 for Irgun, the Zionist terrorist organization that is driving out the hated British from Palestine. And this is the sort of birth of Mossad as the State of Israel is born and the Irgun intelligence arm becomes the Israeli intelligence arm. And I have a couple of histories of Mossad, but this is the sort of heroic origins of Mossad type story. I didn't have it. And again, that sort of pregnant, immediately post-war era turns out to have, you know, set an awful lot of stuff in motion that if you're interested in espionage, even now, it maybe does you good to look back. But I did not have sort of that specifically focused early look at Mossad, so it was good to pick that up.
Hugh Wilford puts the fire in the subtitle with The CIA and Imperial History.
Yeah, this is a British historian, so he's one to talk. But his argument is that the CIA, though it began as an anti-colonial force, driving the Japanese out of occupied Asia and then not turning occupied Asia back over to the Europeans, same deal to a lesser extent with occupied Africa, that eventually became an arm of American imperial power. And I'm not sure who's supposed to be surprised by this knowledge, but I'm sure that Wilford will look down his nose with dudgeon when he describes how it worked. But what it is, interestingly to me, is a British historian of espionage looking at the CIA. I don't have a lot of those. I mostly have either American lefties yelling at the CIA or American righties yelling at the CIA, but differently, or occasionally defensive CIA memoirs by various CIA figures saying, you don't understand, it was much harder than it looked. So it's nice to have a foreign viewpoint on the CIA. It'd be even better to have a Russian one, but most of the Russian books that sell are Russian histories, obviously, of the KGB or the GRU, not looks at the CIA and how ridiculously undermanned it was going up against the Soviets.
This one has more fun in the subtitle than in the title. Raffi Berg's Red Sea Spies, the true story of Mossad's fake holiday resort.
Yeah, the Mossad set up a fake holiday resort in Sudan on the Red Sea. If you wanted to go diving, you could go there. I remember reading about this story some time ago when it came out. And what the fake resort was for was the smuggling of all the Ethiopian Jews out of Ethiopia, which, of course, had turned in the early 80s from a sort of ramshackle and corrupt monarchy into a Soviet client state. And guess what? That is always bad news for local minorities. So the Ethiopian Jews were thinking maybe we should get to Israel now. And Mossad set up that sort of pipeline for them, much of it, apparently, in the guise of a cool scuba resort. So just a fun story all the way around, a nice good guys win type thing, and relatively, I assume, little secret murder in the back room and lots of, oh no, we have to pretend to be working at a four-star dive resort. This is the worst thing I've ever done for my country.
Well, we're through the spy books now and everyone's clamoring, what about the occult books? What about the occult books? Well, how about European Paganism, The Realities of Cult from Antiquity to the Middle Ages by Ken Dowden?
And before anyone gets all excited, let me warn you, this comes from Routledge, and therefore it is intensely serious. It does not have any truck with your nonsense. Ken Dowden wants to discuss how cult ritual worked in pagan Europe. What was the mechanics of worshiping that sacred rock or that sacred stream? He's not letting people get away with it when they just say, oh, the whole natural world was sacred. He says, was it? Where did they sacrifice? Who did they sacrifice? When did they do it? What's going on? So he is sort of breaking down almost a sociology of religion, but for pagan Europe, which means based on the same nine sources that we all use. So it'll be interesting to see how someone with the rightly tough-minded standards of a Routledge author runs up against the generally disastrous state of the data. But if this guy, Ken Dowden is doing the good work that Ronald Hutton has done in Britain, then good for him. I'm excited to have it.
Next up, Magus, The Art of Magic from Faustus to Agrippa by Anthony Grafton.
Yeah, this is sort of a wild thing. I'm not even sure why Grafton sort of took it into his head to do it. My understanding is he's not really a historian of magic, but, you know, you get interested in magi, I get it. And his argument is that during the Renaissance, the Magus is a specific cultural figure, and that the real Faust and the fictional Faust between them sort of define it, and that it runs up until the 30 Years' War takes all the fun out of believing nonsense. And so it goes, in this case, through to Agrippa, although I think you could probably take it a little farther down the road if you wanted to. But the notion is, what is the figure of the European Magus in the Renaissance? And so this is almost a cultural history of that, and very attractive because it's a Penguin book.
The most intriguing title on your list to me is The Nantios Grail, The Evolution of a Holy Relic by John Matthews, Ian Pegler, and Fred Stedman Jones.
Yeah, the Nantios Grail is a magic cup that has been kept in a remote manor in Wales for a great long time. And I ran across the Nantios cup because it is one of the things that Arthur Machen uses to cite his Grail theories, which is that the Grail is a old Celtic church mystery, and that the way that the Nantios cup is treated can tell you how the Celtic church would have treated the Grail, and so therefore, here we are. But when I turned over this book, which is by the lovely, what do I want to say, Elliptonist, New Ager, John Matthews, as well as another couple of people I don't know, and I thought, oh, the Nantios Grail, I know that from Machen, but it was stolen in 2015. So now there is a stolen Grail, and that put it into my box. So I'm very excited that the theft of the Nantios Grail both happened, and it apparently was undone. They found the Grail again. So it's once more on display.
It was briefly a MacGuffin.
And as I believe anyone knows, if a Grail is a MacGuffin, you got stuff going on.
The Grail is notably one of the biggest MacGuffins of all. Speaking of cultural references, The New Prometheans, Faith, Science, and the Supernatural Mind in the Victorian Fin de Siècle by Courtney Raya.
This is from my buddies at the University of Chicago Press. Had I not known that, just looking at the back cover, you would think University of Chicago Press, you're getting a little leptonic there. But a lot of it is a bunch of quotes from other people. So the actual back cover text is not so bad. This is about the Society for Psychical Research and the sort of specific scientists who were early members of it. Sir William Crookes, Frederick Myers, Sir Oliver Lodge, and Andrew Lang, the fairy guy. And all of them were part of the Society for Psychical Research. And this is about, you know, sort of the degree to which new science became the new magic so gradually that you barely even noticed it. And it's part of the University of Chicago Press's sort of, they've been doing some good publications in this era of the sort of the re-enchantment, as it is called, of the West with our new version of woo after we became too big to believe in fairies, I guess.
Now, sometimes in Bookshelf, we have to play the hits. That brings us to London's Ley Lines, Pathways of Enlightenment by Chris Street.
There was no way in the universe that I was not going to buy this book. This is a straight up, here are London's Ley Lines. Here is a map of London's Ley Lines. Here is all the cool things along each of the Ley Lines. Are these Ley Lines real? Of course not. They're a big, beautiful pentagram. But do they go over London? Yes, they do. As I say, at some level, you got to play the hits. And this is a soft, low lob right to me. No way I'm not snapping it up. And it goes with my other British Ley Line books, of which I have several.
And finally, a very exciting title that you've left for last, The Occult Harry Smith, The Magical and Alchemical Work of an Artist of the Extremes, edited by Peter Valente.
Yeah, Harry Smith, I believe we've mentioned a couple of times. He came to my mind first as a folklorist and ethnomusicologist. He gathered the great Smithsonian Anthology of American Folk Music album, but he was also a alchemist of the mind. He did not actually have bubbling retorts. He was sort of one of those Jungian-type alchemists who thinks of it all as symbology, get very into Robert Flood. He has a huge occult side to him and was something of a fixture of the New York occult scene when he lived there. This is some of his occult work, as well as some works on Harry Smith by other students of Smith and students of the occult. So there is a full-on bunch of studies of various little bits of Harry Smith's occultism, as well as a largely unpublished screed by Smith himself. So hopefully, if we ever do a big Harry Smith thing, I'll be prepped. And also, if I ever go back to American folk music as magic, I will also have Harry Smith to guide me.
So this brings us to the end of your pile, and coincidentally, to the end of the year. And listeners, you may be thinking, end of the year? What happened to the Dragon Meet Live episode? Well, tragedy struck, a tragedy that I am still looking for a way to blame on someone else. It's a miracle that it took this long, but there was a recording mishap. He says, using the passive voice to exonerate himself, and we have no recording of it. So this is going to be our last episode of the year. When we are back, which will be on January 9th, we will attempt to recreate the magic of that live event. We've searched our memories and the memories of several attendees to recall what the questions were, because there's some lovely fun questions. So we're going to do a canned recreation, a Peter Frampton not live, if you will, of the Dragon Meet Live episode. Until then, we're taking our customary 2-week holiday break. So we wish you a Merry Christmas, a happy holiday, whatever occasion you wish to celebrate, even if it's just going to movies and eating Chinese food. Have a good break, and we'll be back again on January 9th with Dragon Meet Not Quite Live. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flag Bearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep our maps properly secreted by joining such backers as
Randy Shipp,
Ryan Lassiter,
Chris Farrell,
James Kiley,
and John Buckley.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.